Welcome back, everybody. It's great to be here with you and Ben. Thank you very much for inviting me to host the panel again. I last did so 4 years ago. My name is Johnny Gray. I'm a consultant. I specialize in risk, integrity, and good governance in sport. And so this panel, I'm also a bit nervous, not for the reasons described before lunch by other speakers, but because I've decided to use my notes in my desire to go paperless. My notes are on my phone, so if I get a fat finger, I'm going to erase them, and we're going to have to wing it. But so that's why I'm nervous. So anyway, I'm really pleased to be here with you. This panel is about partnerships, and we wanted to just, talking with the panel beforehand, we wanted to just get a little bit beyond partnerships in our discussions today and talk about compromise, because I think we can all see that laying on a major event is, of course, a partnership. It takes a village. But as we saw this morning from the polls, there are lots of different stakeholders involved who all have slightly competing agendas. And to lay on a great event, you've got to find your way through to a partnership which involves compromise. I'll just very briefly tell you a little story about what I've been doing for the last 3 years to give you an illustration of what I mean. So I spent the last few years setting up a thing called the International Tennis Integrity Agency to transform the integrity of the world of tennis, which has some challenges around match fixing, doping, and the like. And this was a partnership, if you like, between the sport, the governing bodies, the rights holders, the players, but also the betting industry, WADA, broadcasters, sponsors. And one of the areas that we had to work through and find compromise on and find common ground on was the area of betting sponsorship and what the sport would allow and what it would not allow. And how did we compromise commercial issues and considerations with integrity issues and considerations. And so we found a way through. You will not see a tennis player anywhere in the world in a professional game wearing the logo of a betting company on their uniform, on their apparel. And that was because the sport decided that nobody who could influence the outcome of a tennis match could be in a commercial relationship with a betting company. Other sports have not found a way through on that. And so that was a result of compromise. So this panel is all about cooperation, but also compromise. So I'd like to welcome the panel, first of all. And we've got a great panel today, which basically covers off the stakeholders. So representing a host city, I'm really happy to have Joel Laverty with us from Birmingham. And he looks after the Birmingham West Midlands Growth Company. Joel, welcome. Representing a rights holder, a sports rights holder, we have Hilary Atchison from the Federation, International Hockey Federation, FIH. Welcome. Representing the organisers of a major cultural event, we have from Edinburgh, Juliet Amor, from the who's the Director of Festivals Edinburgh. Juliet, hello. And then finally, disrupting the world of major events. We have Helen Marriage from Artichoke, who staged free to attend open-air art festivals in cities. Welcome. Just before we get into our discussion, I'd like to now do a poll, please. And we're going to talk about compromise and how easy or difficult is it. So if we can bring up the poll, if somebody's going to do, where is, oh, Ben, there we are. Thank you. Great. So if you could kindly just complete this survey, and let's get a sense of how you feel about compromise. great. Well, we're sort of settling there. And as a consultant, I'm absolutely delighted that you're all saying it's tricky. Otherwise, I would find myself out of a job very quickly. So I think that's great, because if you'd all said very easy, this panel perhaps would have had its work cut out to keep you engaged for the next period. So taking that as our benchmark, if you like, let's now talk about compromise and cooperation. And I think the first question we'd like to talk about really is coming back from COVID. How easy and difficult was that? What compromises were needed? We've got two major events here who have come back from COVID, very high profile. So let's hear from them. Juliet, can you start perhaps just talking about Edinburgh Festival came back. I live in Edinburgh. I know that was tricky and challenging, and I'm sure you had to cooperate with a lot of people and compromises had to be reached.
Sure, yes. Is this working? Yes, it is. Thanks very much for having me here at House City. First one since before the pandemic. I'm thrilled to be out of the house. And just to explain, Festivals Edinburgh is like a mini chamber of commerce, really, for the 11 major international festivals that have sprung up around the city in Edinburgh, with the first three being founded as a sort of act of hope and positivity after the Second World War in 1947. So we kind of felt that we needed to tap into that spirit again, coming back. And we came back in a small way in 2021, but there were tighter regulations up here in Scotland than in the rest of the United Kingdom about event distancing and hygiene regulations, which meant we were only able to come back at about 10% really in 2021. So yes, 22 was the big year. It was very good for a sort of disruptive innovation, you know, because we were able to engage with the emotions of people in the city about loving the major event. Because if it happens in your city every year for 74 years, you know, people can start to see the downsides of it. And people can also start to associate a lot of things that happen in a capital city more generally, like busking or, you know, like use of public parks for things other than walking your dog in the morning, with festivals. So in terms of that compromise piece, I think one of the things is having a real dialogue with the city stakeholders, the elected representatives and the residents, to kind of tease out, well, what is it that festivals bring and what do they demand of the city? And I think actually the pandemic kind of allowed us to do that. I think also the alliances and industry groupings that we'd been able to tap into during the pandemic were quite transformative, not necessarily because we are natural allies, but actually because we needed to understand each other better. So I think cultural events, sporting events, business events don't always feel that they're swimming in the same ocean, but I know Host City Conference has a lot of suppliers in the audience, and we saw during the pandemic that we definitely did swim in the same ocean, and we sort of saw where our models were very different, but where we could make common cause and make the case for the kind of support that the live events industry needed. And I think finally, I would say data and the ability to demonstrate the difference that the festivals make in Edinburgh was very important in being able to come back and get the confidence of the authorities at local and national level in coming back and understanding the funders understanding better, you know, how can you provide a free event? Because it's increasingly difficult to provide a free event. And what is the cost of free? So I think the economics of the festivals was kind of laid bare a little bit more, and that has helped us to make the case for some emergency Omicron funding to kind of stabilise the situation in 2022 when we were coming back with horrific headwinds, which, as everybody knows, are kind of morphing but continuing. So we came back in the end at about 80% of the creative content of 2019, which was a record year in itself. And so we're back at a economic impact of north of £200 million for Scotland every year, and about 4,000 directly created jobs and about 44,000 in Edinburgh's leisure and arts industry more generally. So we're very pleased about that. We're in new territory now that I'm sure everybody will be talking about how we might be able to navigate that. But so far, so good.
Well, that's excellent. And is it right to say that, just listening to what you're saying there, that actually COVID provides you with the space to re-engage with your partners and just understand everybody's agenda? Am I taking that too far? No,
I think that is true, because business as usual was suspended for a while, you know, and that did give... One of our festival directors said we made 5 years' worth of innovations in 2 years, because we had to come back in some cases as hybrid festivals. Now, there isn't a business model for that we can find in the arts world, because we don't own people's performing rights. But at the same time, you know, we now have a lot of capabilities that we didn't have, and we had the time to speak in a different way to build those relationships and that trust.
Excellent. Joel, I mean, we heard before lunch about the fantastic success of the Games, the Commonwealth Games in Birmingham. You hadn't done it before, so you had COVID. If you were coming out of COVID in the planning, can you talk a bit about the cooperation required to lay on an event of that magnitude coming out of a pandemic? And what was that? Did that require compromise in certain areas?
Well, I think, just to quote Paul this morning, you know, I think he said something along the lines of major events are part of our COVID recovery. And if you think about the Commonwealth Games was kind of the first event coming back out of that kind of horrendous couple of years that seems like a distant memory yet, I think what you saw in Birmingham was the result of people hungry to meet again and unite and you know, using the power of events to bring people together. 1.5 million tickets sold, 2.5 million being part of the cultural festival, 4.5 million people actually visited the city of Birmingham to soak up the atmosphere. So, you know, do major events play an important part in the recovery and bringing people together? Absolutely, yes. And the sun shone for 2 weeks in Birmingham, which was an added bonus. But I think... It was an event in itself. But I think we saw in stark, you know, in front of our eyes, the power of major events to drive footfall into city centres, to bring people together and recreate that important thing around major events, which is people at the heart of major events. And certainly the people of the city, I think, shone through as part of the Commonwealth Games experience that we all look back on with great affection now.
Bringing a sport out of a pandemic, I know from tennis, is a real challenge, and definitely compromises had to be made. In hockey, how did it work for you?
Well, in terms of the portfolio, for example, under the Pro League, which is one of our international, it's our worldwide league for 9 men's and 9 women's nations, having 11 hosts in a normal season provides a requirement for quite a degree of compromise. But imagining under the COVID environment where all different parts of the world were touched by that in different ways and in different times in a different aspect. So there was a lot of compromise simply to get matches and sport played. We had to make decisions about having no fans in the stadium, as I'm sure everyone in this room was thinking about as well. We had to extend the calendar, so we were a 6-month league, we're now a 9-month league, to make sure that was able to have full opportunity. That requires additional buy-in from sponsors. It's not an easy discussion. Also, it impacts on other leagues and other events around the world. And we had to, for example, in terms of integrity, we would usually have neutral match officials. Unfortunately, that wasn't always possible because we simply couldn't get people into areas in order to allow that neutrality. So we did have to think differently. It certainly enhanced the pace at which we were doing that. But it also drove creativity, and I think that's where we are now coming out of that. So, for example, we would usually have commentators in all of those hosting nations. We, during COVID, and now we continue to do that, have centralised commentary. And that is better for the world. It's better for many situations. But as a result of that, we've proven it's possible and are able to continue it. We have teams of officials, male and female officials, officiating together as part of teams going forward. So lots of creativity, but it definitely was a difficult period and required lots of discussion and collaboration.
As a disruptor, you're trying to get events done. Coming out of COVID, that must have been particularly difficult, Helen.
Just for anyone who doesn't know, what we do is put on very large scale events in public space without any charge to the public. So there's no barriers, there's no ticketing, there's no nothing. It's always hard. It's always a compromise because we as an organisation have no authority and no agency to make anything happen. We're not an established part of any city's council or any governmental agency, anything. So we're always trying to make happen what we do through persuading people who are generally reluctant to say yes to stop saying no. So COVID was just another hurdle in that great sort of list of jumps that we have to go over. And we did in 2021, prior to the Commonwealth Games, we ran our biennial Lumiere Durham, tiny little town in the northeast of England, which we create as a sort of giant open-air art gallery is the best way to describe it. And there was a lot of negotiation about whether you could safely entertain the idea of a town of 40,000 people, medieval streets, very narrow, very cobbled, usually wet, hosting 240,000 people, which is what is the number that come over four nights. How it was possible to do that it was less about compromising, it was about evolving partnerships between people who really badly wanted this event to happen. And I think that's always at the heart of our success, is helping the people who are in authority, whose instinct, well, you said to me earlier, status quo means don't let it happen because everyone's anxious about saying yes, because to say yes might be to make a mistake. So our job, as I see it, is both to work with the artists to curate their work, but as much to work with the authorities to help them get rid of the anxiety so that they are comfortable when I say, you know, can we do this? And they generally say, but why would we do that? I think the only answer that I've evolved that is of any use in that situation is, but why wouldn't you? The treasure, the thing that you're aiming for has to be so appealing and so rich. And you can cite all the metrics. You can say, you know, we can say in Durham, tiny town, £40 million of inward investment over the years that we've run it there, which is huge for that place. So we can cite all the jobs created and the training programs and all of that kind of stuff. But in the end, none of that matters. It's actually about what people feel and what the emotional buy-in is, and that it makes them proud and happy and feel better about themselves and the place that they suddenly see is in a spotlight. So that's where we try and end up.
Fantastic. Thank you. Well, Hilary, you touched on it. I think I think we all agree in this room, and certainly I've written about it recently, that ESG is probably coming out of COVID is going to be one of the next great challenges for sport. Not just environmental, social, and governance, but also inclusion, diversity, and access. So let's just talk about this for a second or two. And I want to go to you first, Hilary, because as a sports rights holder, people are bidding to you for the right to hold events. How do you see ESG as a rights holder? How important do you see that coming? And, you know, how do you square the circle of, on the one hand, everybody's flying in, arriving from all over the world to participate, your officiating teams and so on, with, on the other hand, trying to really be a custodian of the planet? Where's the balance there?
It's a good question, and I think it's probably one of the questions of the day and some of the themes we've touched on already. So firstly, as a rights holder, We have, as many federations are, either doing or have just launched a sustainability policy which lays out what our objectives and ambitions are for that particular area. And of course, included in that, a link to how we would like to ideally work with partners for our events. I mean, clearly at the moment, we haven't answered the E question and worked out how we can virtually play hockey in one space against someone who's not actually there in another space. So for the time being, we do have to have people actually in places. But then I think it's about some of the ways we do that. So one of our new formats, which has just launched, the Hockey Fives format, is a smaller urban focused format, which has been launched recently in Lausanne. We put that in a central space, existing space. We made it free to the public with the support of Lausanne City, and we worked directly. So a new model of working for us, normally we would primarily work through a national association, and then the national association would work with the city. But in this case, we worked directly with the city, which I think allowed us to have great conversations about how we can best achieve certain things. We offered the opportunity for sports participation, so people to experience the sport while we were there, and having local suppliers and things in terms of the food retail trucks and things like that. And additionally, it provided the opportunity to pilot with one of our partners, so Polytan, our new carbon zero turf. And that, along with our ambition to be waterless in the future, is one of the key areas where we feel we can contribute and work with stakeholders, not only cities, but also commercial partners for the future.
Thank you. And Joel, Birmingham, we had before lunch, really looking to the future now. And to what extent does environmental issues and ESG playing a sort of consideration in how you would partner with a rights holder to lay on an event?
Yeah, interesting. The panel previous, Mike, that Mike chaired, was talking about sustainability. And I was at a conference last week where we were trying to get our heads around the definition of what sustainability means. So you can either go very narrow. In old money was, you know, reusable plastics at events and, you know, delivering an event, you know, within, you know, responsibly. But the kind of new definition that seems to be emerging around sustainability is how do you deliver a sustainable impact, which is around kind of social, environmental, economic impact, you know, quality of life, young people, fairness, inclusion, diversity. So I think the event industry, and we're a colleague, Chris Jordan, who's the head of events at Birmingham City Council, and I are looking at how we start to bring events into the city and the region of the West Midlands, and looking at it through a sustainability lens. So when we always talk about purpose and impact, why are we delivering the event and what impact do we want it to have? And that very first evaluation of the event starts to look at the purpose and how we can use the event for a greater good and how we can leverage some of those wider impacts across it. And hopefully that will sound familiar to a lot of people in the audience, because I think we've all got a responsibility to do that and kind of, you know, deliver events better and with more conscience and more impact for the way we deliver it as an industry.
And you see that as a partner with the rights holder, do you? Talk a bit more just about how that dynamic works.
Well, some are better at it than others. Every partner is different. You know, some, you know, I think governing bodies and sports find it very easy to get into that kind of territory quickly because of the nature of the events and the type of audience they reach and their profile. Some sports struggle or find it more challenging to kind of find their place in that. But I think, you know, just speaking about it more broadly, you know, inclusion and diversity is an attitude. It's not a policy. You know, it's the way you approach what you do. And I think that we can all make a kind of contribution to that. And I think whatever side of the fence you sit on, whether you're a commercial rights holder as an international federation or a commercial partner or a host city, I think it's everybody's responsibility to look at it through that sustainability lens. So I think as long as you can all agree on that, it's fairly, what did we decide in? Tricky. It can be tricky, but I think it's doable.
Yeah, I think it's very tricky. I mean, I worked for Visa taking them into Brazil, and their guest program as a FIFA partner, they have 10,000 visitors who come in to participate in the games, and you're thinking, wow, would you really do that these days? So I think compromises are going to be tricky, and be fascinating to see how it's going. Edinburgh Festivals, of course, you know, live in person, it's the vibe, it's the atmosphere, it's all that. You talked earlier on, Julia, about coming out of COVID, you know, chance to slightly reset and think through what you're doing. How have you taken on the ESG challenge in the Edinburgh Festivals?
I think some very practical examples of how our peak season festivals have come back with environmental sustainability in mind. And we have the same definition of cultural, social, economic and environmental sustainability all as a part of a system, is with the International Festival, they persuaded two world-class companies this year to come for a residency, effectively. So the Philadelphia Orchestra and International Theatre Amsterdam, who would normally maybe come and play three performances and then go somewhere else, were both in town for more than a week. And you know, when you actually calculate that in terms of the size of the company, that makes a huge difference in terms of your programming spend and the way that, a little bit like elite sports people, elite artists have been kind of used to flying around the globe. And there's a lot of discussion about how we can make work differently. Some of that is to do with technical things, to do with 3D virtual modeling of venues so that people can do all the backroom work before the production is mounted as a virtual thing. But then ultimately it will come down to how do you become efficient. I think you were using that word, Hilary, about the performances that you're putting on. And we do have, I think, a natural advantage in as much as, you know, Edinburgh is somewhere where 70 different countries are presenting their cultural work, and we are a focal point for the world in August for performing arts and all of the kind of interplay with screen arts and digital that's starting to come around that. So we take that responsibility seriously. The Fringe Society has developed an industry program online through COVID. We're not expecting that to be the be-all and end-all of industry interaction, but people are much more accepting now of scouting work at certain stages anyway from online interactions. So we're trying to figure out the best way of kind of embedding that in our business model as part of a hybrid. But we will always stay true to the idea that live human interactions are, you know, at the core of the value that people want the festivals to bring. It was interesting to see from COP27, I don't know if anybody caught the other day, there was a tourism report saying that in their view, and they are academics of tourism, long-haul passenger volumes need to stay static between now and 2050 in order to for the tourism industry to kind of pivot itself. I see some shaking heads in the audience, but we don't have the answers, but we are looking at the mix of how our festivals are appealing to people around the world. And certainly in terms of our own work, we are switching our collective marketing effort to short haul. And we are thinking in terms of long haul relationships, we're thinking of those much more as professional relationships, industry relationships, and relationships for the kind of talent attraction that we know are city partners like the universities and so on, you know, see us as a real advantage for Edinburgh, for Scotland and for the UK. So we're just trying to drive more value out of those kinds of interactions rather than go for the interactions that are higher volume and lower value.
Yeah, fascinating. If I think of all the American tourists in Edinburgh over the summer, that's an interesting sort of challenge. Just staying on that theme, but if we can just, Helen, explore in a bit more detail. We heard from Hilary that a key part of their new FIES format in Lausanne, I think Hilary heard right, was that a lot of it would be free to access. And so I think this is also a coming trend. So free events, which is your bag, how do we get that right with the need for the city? You talked about how much Durham is making financially out of this, and we talked about people travelling to see the free event. Where's the balance there, Helen?
It is a question of disruption. I guess the things that we're doing are short-lived, usually 4 days. Is this working? usually, that's better, usually 4 days. And we negotiate with both businesses and residents to alert them to what's happening, to facilitate their access to the benefits that the event might give. I would be lying if I said everyone loved it. That would be not true. But the huge benefits, not only financial, but also in terms of profile, in terms of, as Julia's just said, you know, the city benefiting long-term from being seen as a sort of cultural destination, a place where interesting things happen. All of those things are to be carefully negotiated with the people whose lives are necessarily disrupted. We did a big event. We've done several big events in London, and closing down a world city for 4 days is no mean feat. And when you have, I don't know, a million and a half people on the streets for those 4 days, it becomes a really protracted negotiation. These things take 2-3 years to set up, and a lot of that is about working with public authorities, but also residents groups and interest groups that exist in particular places to ensure that their opinion is heard, even if you can't always facilitate exactly what they want. Because quite often what they want is for the thing not to happen. but it's a complicated sort of matrix. But it is all to do with having conversations. And what we found is having conversations in person, being there, say, you know, attending the AGM or going to the meeting and saying, this is what's happening and this is how we will facilitate your access and all of that stuff, is the only way that it really works. You know, sending out an email or, you know, putting up a poster or something saying road closed is not the way to do it.
Right, right. Let's talk a bit more about legacy. And we heard earlier on about the legacy in Birmingham, Joel. I think I'm just going to come to you, slightly off script now, Hilary, actually. I'm going to come to you and just say, from a rights holder's point of view, you know, you want to run your event and then, you know, the second it's over, there's another event next week in another part of the country or the world or whatever. How can sports remain engaged for legacy after their event is over? And if this is slightly unfair on you because I didn't warn you on this, I appreciate any thoughts you can have on that. I'm interested in it.
Yeah, I think there are a number of different aspects of legacy. One of them would be the infrastructure legacy. Now, you can either, if that's a temporary solution, then obviously that temporary solution could go somewhere else and be utilised again, which links to our sustainability discussion. But if it's a fixed infrastructure, then it can be opened up to the community and, you know, the national associations extend the legacy then of the international rights holder or the rights holding body and put in place the programmes hopefully to support the opportunity that the infrastructure presents. You have the people legacy. I'll use a lovely example from Glasgow to Birmingham in terms of the Commonwealth Games. There's a programme here for 2014 where sport coordinators joined the teams in Glasgow, a young person from the city. That sport coordinator was our hockey manager in Birmingham for the Commonwealth Games. So 8 years later, there was a legacy and the industry will continue to benefit from that. So there are a variety of different legacies and the responsibility for them is not all with the rights holder explicitly, but also by the extensions of those. We have an academy, I'm sure many of the federations have the same situation, where we can utilise the opportunity that events provide to now virtually do education and as a mixture now in our new world, blended education, both practical and online, we can extend out that opportunity to more people to connect and to be educated either as officials or coaches or volunteers in our sport. So I think many opportunities exist.
Thank you. And Joel, on that theme, how do you keep the sponsors of the major event and maybe others involved in staging them, how do you keep them engaged after that event is over and try and bring them into legacy as well? Is the thinking you've got on that in West Midlands and Birmingham?
This isn't going to be a straightforward answer, yeah, as you could guess. I think talking about sponsorship, it's very, very difficult to do that. First of all, I'd ban the word legacy because I don't believe it exists, and other people in the room may agree or disagree, but I think it's an overused word, and I think it's...
How would you define it now?
We define it in Birmingham as purpose and impact. Why are we delivering the event, and what impact do we want it to achieve? I've been lucky enough to spend a lot of time with colleagues here in Scotland who've got great deal of admiration for and of the work that they've done building on the Commonwealth Games in 2014. A lot of what we did in Birmingham was working from the best that they did, which was put people at the heart of the major event and, you know, make sure that the event was for the city and of the city and reflected the city, and that the legacy was baked into the funding and delivery model, that it wasn't, I use legacy, the L word, but, you know, the impact that you were trying to achieve was baked in from the outset in terms of the budget planning. It wasn't an afterthought. Yep. I was involved in an event here called the Cycling World Champs in 2023 in some of the planning for that. And we talked about the 4 years before and the 4 years after, not just the post-event, what are we going to do for the kids kind of thing. I'm exaggerating to make a point, but... I think
a free art exhibition or something.
Yeah, I think the cultural festival, you know, that the work that we've done in communities, the £6 million that Birmingham gave to 600 community organisations to deliver impact in their neighbourhoods locally, was the thing that makes people connect with the event. The work that we're doing to kind of use, as leader Ian Ward said in his piece, that the Commonwealth Games is the start line, not the finish line. It's about the next golden decade of major events that we're busily trying to attract. Where we announced the European Athletics Championships coming to Birmingham and Alexander Stadium last Friday. As Councillor Ward pointed to, we won that bid. So the same day we announced the Kabaddi World Cup will be coming to West Midlands in 2025, and that's got its roots in South Asian part of the world, but also obviously communities in Birmingham and the West Midlands that have got that connection and heritage to South Asia, India, Pakistan. So, you know, we're kind of doing a lot to make sure that whatever we do cuts through and is meaningful and has impact and is driven by our values around youth and diversity and inclusion, so that anything we do in the future means something to the region. It's not just an initiative to do whatever, I suppose.
Yeah, okay. I've learned we're going to ban the word legacy. It's a very good idea. We are, I think, here in Glasgow, largely as a impact, not legacy, an impact of the 2014 Commonwealth Games. So a living example, I suppose, of that. We've only got a couple of minutes left, ladies and gentlemen, but I wonder if there's any questions from the floor on this general area, if anybody would like to ask any. We've got one from...
Patrick Burke from Inside the Games. A question for Hilary, just picking up on the point about waterless pitches at your events. Is there sort of a timeline in place for when you'd like that to be implemented by? And will that be something that you're sort of demanding of event organisers and host cities for when they stage hockey matches?
So thank you very much for the question. So our chief executive, Thierry Ville, announced our ambition for that in 2018. And the work ongoing has been slightly impacted, like we all have, with the COVID pandemic. Because it does take research and development to move from something that you have existing to something that you're looking to achieve in that way. One of the things we learned from the Hockey Fives was that initially I think we thought that was just about looking at the technology with the turf, but we established that actually it's a conversation in terms of how we're talking about partnerships here between the turf, the ball, the equipment manufacturers, and that was great. That was what we learned through the pilot, and now we are continuing to take that on through the partnership with Polytan and their work in that area. So our ambition for the timeline, as you requested, is to have that technology available for our 2026 World Cups with a view to using it in the 2028 Olympic Games in LA.
Thank you. Question up.
Hello, hello. Anthony Brenneman, Orange County, California. So going off the original poll question about compromise between partners, it had me thinking about, since we were talking about Qatar coming up and originally not going to be selling any kind of alcohol, they ended up making the concession later then. I'm going to theorize that maybe Anheuser-Busch had something to do with that, being a major sponsor of FIFA. So what role do sponsors play in influencing that compromise for any of your events? And if there was somewhat of a controversial sponsor, you know, would you guys be open to having them there? And if you need any examples of what might be controversial, I'm happy to give them to you.
I'll maybe take the first one, having worked for two FIFA partners. Part of the partnership they have with FIFA, so they're not, it's a level above sponsor of the event, it's a global partner, is the right. For example, if you go to the World Cup, you will only be able to use Visa in the stadiums, you will only be able to drink Budweiser products, and certainly in Brazil, where drinking in the stadium was not allowed, you end up with some, you know, discussions, if you like, between the host country and the sponsors as to what accommodations can be reached for that event. And we see normally an accommodation can be reached, and that has happened in Qatar, although I think there are rules around zoning and other things which will be part of that compromise. In terms of sponsors, I don't know if anybody wants to take that. I just think, Hilary, the one thing, I mean, I think we all saw an Australian netball, ladies' netball, that the players refused to wear the new shirt sponsor, an Australian mining company, because of its ESG, alleged ESG issues with First Nation countries. So I think that is going to become more and more of an issue, and it would probably do rights holders well to do due diligence on people wishing to sponsor their events, to just understand what that company is involved in and some of its history and legacy, and maybe even talk to the players about whether they're happy to be associated. That would be novel, wouldn't it?
It is always difficult. I think the ethical issues that surround the sponsorship of big events, it's always a complicated thing, and quite often in my working life, I discover that the sponsor most wants me when they're at their most poisonous. So, i.e. when the most difficult judgment on my part, you know, how much do I need this money? Am I prepared to compromise? We had a big event that we were doing across the four nations of the UK, and part of British American Tobacco approached us to say, can we? And it was all about in that their policy was all about, you know, inventing alternatives to tobacco and nicotine, and I said no.
A no example for you. We had one here and then one behind. Sorry, I think gentleman from Sri Lanka.
Yes, just a little comment about Birmingham. I like to tell everyone here, this is the first time in the world a games has been held without a athlete village being built. This is the first, I think that's a good model, and I always dreamt about this model, and I think you have done well, and it worked very well with Birmingham University, Warwick, Neck Hotels. I think this is the way to move forward. I'm sure other organizers will certainly take this message forward and do it. Thank you.
Yeah, LA 2028 are using the UCLA campus for their athletes village. They're not building one. Andy, up there.
Sorry, was it me? Mine was more of a comment than a question, to be fair, just to pick up on the conversation about sponsors, because most of the people in the room will be aware, but not everybody will, about the recent resignation by the head of British Cycling because of the Shell scenario. So I just think, you know, buyer beware, and do not go, do not follow the money, follow your conscience, follow your heart, follow the research that you do amongst your stakeholders, and the key stakeholders are your fan group.
Thank you. I think that is it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed that panel. I'm not sure we solved the problem of compromise, but I think we talked about how dialogue and discussion are essential in order to understand different points of view and different agendas, and then finding a way through together is probably part of the answer. I'd just like to thank my panel very much indeed for their contributions to this discussion, and we are now handing back to Ben. Thank you, Ben.